I forgot to press record. God damn it.
All right. Well, that one's for the birds.
I forgot to press record.
All right. You want to start it on now?
Yeah, I just pressed it.
Oh, hey,
anyways,
everybody.
welcome to Neon Shrine, show of pilgrimage and power spots.
We just came to a really good idea.
Wow. let me tell you, we've spent the last 45 minutes really chopping it up, really getting to the heart of a really significant issue.
Yeah.
When it comes to power spots.
Well, listen, that wasn't meant to be a monument. That was meant to be a mass ritual.
Castles in the sand. I'll tell you.
Islands in the stream.
Castles in the sand, man. I mean, wow. That's a rough one. Mm. To sit in the ruins of what was once a beautiful castle.
Hey, we still did it.
It's true. You and I know
what happened.
That's right.
We have new ideas now.
Well, this is something that I like to tell myself whenever I'm writing something and I lose a page because the computer crashes or you spill water all over your notebook. Those thoughts were a mere stepping stone.
Yeah.
To getting to other thoughts that I need to have. Mm-hmm. And so the last 45 minutes was a beautiful jewel encrusted
mandala.
Gold gilded
mandala.
Stepping stone to the illuminated point of view that we now have.
Oh, and we won't tell you anything more about it.
Oh my God. I mean, we can give them a preview.
Yeah.
Or even a summary. I mean, preview suggests we're going to go back to it. Basically, we are talking about Notre Dame burning.
Yeah, and all the discussions that were occasioned by it, by people being really sort of sourpuss and cynical and being like, why would we spend all this money rebuilding that old church? Like, nobody even cares about Christianity. It's like a oppressive institution, and France has other problems it needs to deal with.
Give that money to social services.
Yeah.
Give that money to well-meaning politicians.
Fix
give that money to an extremely efficient...
To charities with CEOs who make $1.5 million
a
year.
Yeah, to extremely productive and transparent and effective NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a better use.
That'll ensure the money goes wrong.
And
right.
To that we say fie. We say fie to such humanistic interests.
A plague on both their houses.
That's right. We are unashamed to say that we should transcend human values. We should
and
transcend...
Thus the power spot.
Yes, we should transcend such myopic, anthropocentric impulses. And something like Notre Dame, like the Daibutsu at Kamakura, like
the cave paintings
the
of
cave
Lascaux.
Painting of Lascaux, like the Hagia Sophia. There are certain things humans have done that echo in a universe that is populated by intelligences bigger than us, things we can't ever conceive. And I think that it is these, what do I want to call it? These moments of collective brilliance that participate in that world. And I don't claim to understand what that world is. I don't claim to understand what Notre Dame is. And I think that the people who built it thought they were doing one thing, but in fact were doing another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that other thing that we're interested in. We're not here to defend tradition. We're here to defend these moments of self-overcoming, overcoming what it means to be a human, overcoming the human story, which is, I've always liked this idea. It's in Beyond Good and Evil, but Nietzsche says, you know, human, what a horrible insult, you know, to say you're human, to describe something as human. And so
yeah.
We also say fie to humanism. We're, in fact, anti-humanists.
Yes.
And maybe even anti-human.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, human in the sense
right.
of
what it has become.
Delimiting yourself as a certain object in a world of objects that you
the
act
man
upon.
Man of reason or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Instead of being one jewel in a net of shimmering brilliance, that we're all for.
Yeah.
That's true. That rings true. But this idea that we are the shepherds of nature or the stewards of the planet.
Womp womp.
No. I mean, I'm not interested. It doesn't move me.
Well, that makes me think, too, like, you know, in Kumano Kodo, we talk about power spots and the question of, you know, what distinguishes a power spot from a tourist site, for example. And one of your spiritual masters says, well, a power spot gets better the more people that there are there.
Right.
And a tourist spot gets worse. But that also has me thinking about, like, you know, a place like Notre Dame or any monument or even just the road that is the Camino de Santiago, which is just some dirt and pavement and whatever else. You know, maybe another characteristic of a power spot is that, and this is also a very medieval Christian thing to say, but they sprout, things sprout out of that powerful ground. And sometimes it takes the form of a well. Sometimes it takes the form of a tree. Sometimes it takes the form of a cathedral. And that's kind of, that was another thing I was saying, was like, you know, even if the decision had been to raise Notre Dame to the ground because it was so damaged and turn that into a park or something, would I be upset? Sure. But I'd also be like, yeah, but that's, you can't erase 8 centuries of truth, and beyond that, of 10 centuries of other Christian churches there, and beyond that, the earliest Roman settlements, and beyond, you know, like, you can't erase the power spottiness of that place. And to cut off the head, which in this particular moment is Notre Dame, I think it's a hydra. I don't think that you're going to, that is not going to be erased. But that doesn't mean that I think you should just go around cutting heads off either.
But, you know, listen, I have very little interest in 1,000 years of priestcraft. You know, that's not the value of Notre Dame. It's not about what this institution claims it does or can do.
Yeah.
It's a power spot by virtue of what the people have brought to this particular parcel of land.
Mm-hmm.
The hopes, the dreams, the energies, the wishes, the failures, the anger, the love. It's that vital energy that has drawn people in.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, if Notre Dame was into the ground, that would still exist there. But I think that that vital energy has crystallized.
Yeah.
And it's not like Notre Dame is one thing. Notre Dame is a patchwork of artisans from across the centuries building, changing, adapting, building on. I mean, in many ways, it's like scrapwork.
Yeah.
You know?
It really is.
And it's a testament to, I think, those higher impulses in a way that an office block isn't, or more apartments, or whatever. I don't think that there's anything that, you know, what we could call like too late capitalism could add there. And I don't trust anyone to do it.
Yeah.
And so anyone that wants to tell you, oh, we should let it burn, we should, this to me, I think either the person saying that is a useful idiot or a pernicious land developer. You know, really, either they are a land developer or they're someone who is aiding and aiding and abetting land developers.
Yeah.
Because as long as that stands there, it remains useless.
Right.
And it's that uselessness that I think is important.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if I can just dream out loud for a moment, my vision of Notre Dame is, you know, a giant tree growing through the middle. You know, we're jumping 200 years in the future. People have built, they've added wings to it, you know. The neo-Catholic, Gnostic, galactic church now owns one half of it, and they're selling fish and stale bread on one side, and the other side, you know, people are living in the rafters. Like, as long as it resists the flow of time, as long as it resists the march of capitalism, I think it's a monument, it's a power spot, and it deserves to be reckoned. Now, you know, a minute ago you said, oh, you know, a power spot is a place that gets better as more people go to it, like Mecca, and loses its energy as it's forgotten. I mean, that's true on one level, but I'm trying to think of examples, because it's hard to do, because it's it's hard for me to want to be around a lot of other people.
Well, and also I think, you know, you can't step away from the fact that I think that, you know, something that makes the power spot discussion difficult, and we worked with the whole time about traveler, pilgrim, tourist, is the site can be a power spot and still be a tourist destination, like Notre Dame. You know, everyone I spoke to when I was in Paris recently, and I was talking to a lot of people who are working on the restoration of Notre Dame, they were like, you know, one of the things that the religious community who still uses that building wants is like better crowd control, and also to use it more for like to shift the dial away from being primarily a tourist site that holds mass to being primarily a sacred site that except that accommodates tourists.
How about no tourists? How about you don't let tourists in?
That's the pickle that so many power spots today find themselves in. Is like if you like Hagia Sophia, right? Yeah. Like Erdogan was like, all right, this is just a Muslim prayer space.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that was, and people are upset.
Is that how it is now?
Yeah, and rightly so, because because throughout its history, it's been a church, it's been a mosque, it's been a mosque. And
before that, it was a sacred tree.
Yeah. Before that, it's just like a really important piece of land, you know, and so. I understand the resistance to like wanting to return it to only a religious space, but I think that that's why a lot of power spots seem like they're not better when they're more crowded. It's because they also have this tourism crowding that's happening there. That doesn't take away from the overall value, it does make the experience weird.
No, it's clear though that people are drawn to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fact that people are drawn to it. Now, you know, I saw Hagia Sophia.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was confusing. I didn't know the proper protocol to...
But this was when it was still a historic monument. Like, you could go and not just be there for a service. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I went in as a tourist.
Yeah.
And I did my best to be respectful. You know, you take your shoes off and you
cover up in various ways.
Yeah, yeah, you do your best. But I have to admit, there was a learning curve.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's all. I remember when we were in India. I had never been in a... Well, I'd been in, like, Hindu temples in Singapore, but, like, Singapore, so you just kind of... Everybody kind of just goofs around. But I didn't know the protocols in these Hindu or Buddhist temples, really, in India. And I remember we learned it in... Or you taught me in Japan, the Buddhist versus the Shinto. What do you do in those temples?
Yeah.
You know, that's all...
It helps if you spend money. The gods love it when you spend money. They do.
Sure.
No,
sure.
They really do. Yeah. Like, offerings.
Yeah.
It's an often forgotten... It's an often forgotten aspect of traveling, but foreign gods like money.
And they're like, I don't know you. Why should I talk to you?
Why should I
pay attention?
Yeah, why should I offer you my favor? It's like, listen, I love you clapping and sitting quietly, but I'd really like, you know, if you did a painting or wrote about this. I mean, I think we have enough information about the gods to know more or less what they appreciate, and that's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, much like the Order of St. George the Source defines itself in terms of generosity. So when you do a pilgrimage, it's not what you get.
Yeah.
It's a matter of what you can give to the hospitaleros, to the barkeeps, to the hotel maids, to everybody you encounter, to other pilgrimage. It's about giving gifts. It's about that sort of potlatch mentality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because if you enter into a pilgrimage with a potlatch mentality, then you'll be invited into... You know, the potlatch of the gods. You'll get a little juice, you know, you'll get a little manna. But if you don't, a stingy pilgrim, there are too many of them these days. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're really all pilgrims on this earth, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, when it comes to money, I'm completely convinced that you have to spend it. You know, you can't be a miser about it. You really have to, you know... This Tim Leary idea that money is an energy and you have to participate in the flow of that energy instead of blocking it up.
And of course, that's you know, like everything else we have ever talked about, it's not prescriptive. Like,
no, I'm prescriptive.
By that is like if you've saved and you have $1,000 to buy your plane ticket and do the Camino, when you tip a euro, that's huge.
Yeah, right,
you know, whereas you're like you're not worried about your money. Tipping a euro is just the normal. It's like, what is that spirit of generosity? How does that take form? It might not always be monetary, but it can very easily be monetary. And it's a matter of degree. It's the, you know, it's the classic stories of, you know, the I don't even remember what story this is, but someone gives like a wooden coin and like the prince is mad because he's like, oh, I gave you 5 gold coins. Why are you like him better? And he's like, yes, but you see, that was his last wooden coin
whatever.
You know,
right,
that story. That old Joseph Campbell probably talks about.
No. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, if you can't give a wooden nickel to the barkeep, forget it. I mean, like, you have nothing to offer the gods.
Yeah.
Because there's that idea that, you know, when you're on pilgrimage, everyone is the god.
Yeah.
Everyone you meet is an incarnation.
Ha-ha!
Even you!
Even you!
Even you! Even you!
Give yourself a wooden nickel. Give yourself a pat on the back, everybody.
Yeah,
you
did.
You made it.
You did it. And we're all pilgrims on this earth, so that applies to everybody all the time. So we didn't even get into that book. We just started riffing on how much we dislike...
What book? They don't know.
Well, that's right. That's part of the lost...
The lost archive.
But anyways, so the first book you brought, we can... If you hold it up again, we can boo it once more.
Boo. Yeah, it's called Paris to the Pyrenees, And then the subtitle is, A Skeptic Pilgrim Walks the Way of St. James. And this guy's a journalist who's like a food journalist and written for the LA Times and San Francisco Chronicle and blah, blah, blah. So I'm excited to look into that.
So this is worth mentioning. This is worth mentioning. Bad pilgrim literature bingo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we gotta make that up.
So, you know, we've gone through...
a lot.
Much to my embarrassment, dozens of bad pilgrimage books. In fact, the majority of them are bad. Dozens of them.
Yeah.
And they're all a skeptic's journey.
Yeah, or if they're not a skeptic's journey, then it's also uninteresting in a different way, where it's like, I am a, you know, devout whatever, and here's... Actually, that's more interesting to me.
That's super interesting. I'm totally into that.
I want, like, a deeply Catholic person to be this confirmed everything I thought.
Where are those books? Yeah. Where are those books? I haven't read a single one of those.
No, and even at, like, cathedral or church bookstores on the Camino, we don't see those.
You don't find it, so...
You know what it is? They what they do, because we have that little book from that little church near, not but in Galicia, you picked it up our first time. It was that little booklet by the local priest. But that's just a history of the St. James, and then like a bunch of prayers. So it's not actually a personal narrative. It's just like it's you know, it's for a community. So it's not for this priest to talk about himself.
You know, and here I think there's a few exceptions, like Paulo Coelho's Book of Pilgrimage. At least it's interesting because he beats up some lady's dog. He barges into this person, like, because he's
on a quest.
Yeah, he reads his story as a metaphysical quest.
Yeah.
He is taking extreme liberties.
Yeah.
and acting absolutely, I mean, of course, the whole book's made up. None of that happened. I would even question if he even went to Spain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's all made up.
Yeah. The one thing that has me thinking that he might have visited Santiago, or, like, he might have, like, is that he didn't actually complete it. If you remember in the book, he just takes a bus to the airport.
To find his sword.
Like halfway through. It's like very Monty Python.
I think he gets to like a hill, not maybe even like Monte Gozo or something outside of Santiago. And he's like, oh, I know where my sword is. Bye. He's like within the day's walk of Santiago. He's like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah. So, okay. That I'm all for. And then you have someone like... What's the three-volume St. James book?
Oh, yeah, George Goddard King.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, I think that everything, most things that we read are skeptics' guides.
Yeah.
And those skeptic guides always start off cynical and... No, they all start with a history that poo-poos the legends of St. James and says, hey, look at what all these dumb peasants think. I'm a modern... None of this means anything to me, but I'm facing some type of catastrophe or crisis, so it's time that I do this. Mm-hmm. And I'm usually in my 50s and 60s, whatever, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I've lived a life, and I've done what I'm supposed to do, and
I'm
now
successful.
It's about me.
And I'm great, and this is just another...
Or I've dropped out completely out of society. That's also another... Like, I'm burnt out. That's another story, too.
So, crisis thing. So, I'm going to do this, and off we go on the road, and it's like... You talk about the food and you talk about the places, but it's just kind of a tourist trip. And then something happens and you see the universal appeal of pilgrimage and all roads...
You have a little Camino magic. Something happens.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
all roads lead to the same primordial truth. And then, you know, story of redemption.
Then you go home and never do nobody knows what you've been through.
Oh, but part of that, the bingo, one of the bingo squares is... Imagine if they gave all the money it took to build the cathedral in Santiago to the poor. Mm-hmm. That's a square. Mm-hmm. And you can X off the square if someone says, imagine if they took all the money. Okay. You go to the Vatican. Imagine if they took all the money. Okay, fine. You get the square.
Congratulations. Another square that I would add would be some kind of either like generous or not generous characterization of like a national people. Which is tales all the time. Like, it's in the oldest pilgrimage account. Right.
It's
like,
Codex Calistinius.
Basques are like this.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of... Okay, you can't be lukewarm about it. No. This is what I've learned. Okay, that's a square, which is gross generalizations about entire peoples.
What I've noticed about the Spanish on the Camino.
Right.
What?
What I've noticed about Australians, you know? Okay, if you're going to do that, go all the way. Like the Codex Calixtinus.
Go to Melide and see how you're treated.
Yeah, Melide.
Or Arzua. You know, oh my gosh, I didn't tell you. I found recently a notebook from our very first Camino. And I wrote about how mean the people in our zoo were.
There you go.
Back in 2017. And then we had the same experience with Ricky this past March.
Was there like, who was rude? I can't.
It was everyone we met. Like, we went into the very first bar we went into, we were drinking inside. And then we were wanted to go to the patio, and there was like a plastic thing.
I remember that.
And you went to the bartender, and you're like, can we go outside? And he was like, I don't know. He was like, so. And then we went to dinner, and like, you asked the woman something, and she was like, whatever. Like, there was just this brusqueness that was. Oh, and then we went to another bar, and we asked for like vermouth, and she's like, vermouth, que vermouth?
Oh, that.
What
that,
is vermouth?
Okay.
And we're like, like that right there? And she was like, oh, vermouth.
Dude, seeing with the right eyes, it was
hilarious.
Uproarious farce. And I have to admire it. At the time, I do remember thinking, what the fuck is going on in the city? Because they're, like every other place you visit, people are really generous and open. And you go to what? You go to
our zoo specifically.
Yeah, and everyone is like really curt.
Yeah. But then I remember there was a moment when I think actually it was at that bar when the phone was like, vermouth, what is vermouth? And then we just laughed, like I laughed or Ricky laughed. And she was like,
yeah, okay,
she gave us like a little smile after that.
Yeah.
We just had to realize how absurd we were being, I guess.
But no.
Anyway, listen, yeah, so I found my journal.
Oh my God. And you comment on it.
7 years ago. And it was like, for some reason, the people in our zoo are really mean.
Yeah, that's great.
I know.
So here's the thing. You read the Codex Calixtinus, which is a 12th century document, the first pilgrim's guide for the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, and it's worth reading just because it's a historical document, and it's full of a lot of really excellent sort of tidbits and music, and it's really kind of essential reading, but it just goes all in when it comes to trashing people from a certain town.
Yeah, and some people, like, I think there's some places, like, his highest compliment is, like, they smell nice. Like, he's like, I'll grant you, they don't smell so bad. This is a Frenchman writing about this.
Yeah, Picard.
Picardy, yeah. Okay, now I remember. Sorry, I have one more thing to say about
No, go.
I remember specifically what kicked off our funny experience was we went to the Meat Mountain restaurant that we had been at that was so delicious, and we didn't go this time
because
it was closed. So we showed up, it was open. We walked in, and you asked, like, what time is dinner? And the person looks at you and shrugs and goes, dinner time?
Dinner time?
And then I cackled, and she like gave me a little smile, and we just laughed.
I remember that.
I was like, man.
What time is dinner? Dinner time.
Yeah, I don't know about dinner time. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
The one thing I've noticed is what draws all of these stories together, it's we walk into a bar. Like that's how all of these tales begin, which is like three travelers walk into a bar.
Very D&D.
The bearded one makes a... inquires about something. Actually, this is fantastic Dungeons and Dragons, which is like your party enters a bar and just gets nothing out of the bartender. Yeah, they just
Do you have any problems here? What do you mean?
Why you bringing
like,
some?
Do you have like goblins? I don't know. Do you have goblins?
What are you gonna do if we do? Oh my God! So let's take a little break, play some tunes, and then come back and let's read the conclusion.
Yeah, of this dinky book.
And see if we can get more squares for the pilgrimage bingo. First one is, imagine if they gave all the money something else. Second one is, gross generalizations about entire people.
There's so many more we could do.
Like what?
I mean, probably like a tough day, and then you see like a thing, an animal or a tree. Like you who have this moment of like inner peace after like wanting to quit.
Oh, I was about to say, even if I can go a little further on that one, food tastes better after a long day of walking.
Well, that's true.
Okay, I'm saying it's part of the bingo. And here's something. You don't see it in our book. Thankfully, these don't appear in Kumano Kodo.
No, in Kumano Kodo they don't. But we do talk about delicious fried chicken. But that's just
fried straight up. right at the beginning of a day, some lady's selling fried chicken. We're like, yeah, we'll eat
yum,
that.
Yum, yum. Yeah, fair enough. Oh, you know what is not on the bingo card, but it's on our bingo card, if you're a fan of our books?
So bingo card is bad. If it's on the bingo card, it's a cliche.
Okay, but we have a separate bingo card, which is like, how do you identify Stella and Joe?
We got two bingo cards going right now?
This bingo
we got
card
a
is
bad pilgrimage account
is,
bingo card.
It's Order St. George's Horse Publications good checklist.
So we got a bad pilgrimage book bingo card, and we got a OSGH good pilgrimage bingo card. So we can just call it the
good. And one of them is any talk of poop. I've never seen any other book talk about poop.
Talk about shitting. Yeah. All right, so let's just simplify it. We have a bad pilgrim card and a good pilgrim card.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay.
So shit is the square
in the
middle.
The only one you want to put on the good pilgrimage card is talking about shitting.
So far.
Okay.
We have to build these out.
Okay, let's go a little bit more.
It's a 5x5 square.
I would say lavish descriptions of food and drink. And it's difficult for me because, you know, even in this, this guy's a foodie, this guy is a food journalist, and I flicked through it last week. He mentions that he likes it.
Mm.
And he compares it, but he doesn't give a full or rich or thick description of the color of the meat or the cooking. It's a different type of writing. And it's often, if you're a restaurant reviewer, you're not doing that. You're existing more in a restaurant world than you are in this, like,
experiential.
I want you to talk about food as though you've never eaten that food before. Instead of, I've eaten everything, and I want to compare it to this, and I want to compare it to that. It's like, I want you to pretend as though this is the first time you've had a roasted duck.
Right.
And describe to me what that roast... So I used to put out this fanzine called The Fart Times. Right, which was... It was a review zine of vegan anarchist kitchens.
In Amsterdam.
And the one thing that was not allowed in the zine was an evaluation of how the food tasted.
Because it always tasted the same.
Or whatever. But it's like, talk to me about the cutlery. Talk to me about the color.
How cheap is the beer?
Yeah, it was an exercise in thick description, an anthropological viewing.
Yeah.
Instead of comparison.
Yeah.
Or value. I frankly don't give a shit about either of those things.
Yeah.
And none of them matter in 8 months when that restaurant's closed.
Right.
What will ring out is how heavy was the plate? You know, what was the smell coming out of that sort of... Or you know, did you see a grocery bag of onions rotting by the door?
Yeah.
I mean, these are the type of things I want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a really great book called Night Market Noodles.
Oh, yeah.
By Peter Lambert Wilson. That's all thick food description.
Yeah.
And it's like... Yeah, the book carries an odor. It's really the model here. I should go back to that.
Yeah, yeah. That would be good for us to look at for the Camino book. Because there's so many deep food experiences that we've had.
Yeah.
And it's really not about how good the food is. Because that suggests a kind of objective, I know what good food is thing. And really it's the sum of its parts. You know, it's so much more leads into deciding that I absolutely cannot get enough of this potato dish.
The problem with food writers is they mistakenly believe anyone gives a shit about their taste. So much food writing is about cultivating a taste, cultivating discernment, and then being able to describe flavors, textures, blah, 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 to people who don't have that discernment.
Yeah.
That's the gap that defines food writing. And frankly, I don't give a shit about this stuck-up prick's attitude, you know, because, you know, this, of course, you know, if he wants to have a sort of low-class dalliance, he'll eat Taco Bell. Well, fuck you. I love Taco Bell. You know what I mean? So he's not speaking to me.
No.
And food critics rarely do. I'm not the person that's, you know. And this is why I disregard all best of best tacos in the Mission.
We were having dinner with Mac and his partner last night, and they remarked that a new article had come out, like rating the best Mexican joints in the Mission, and they were like, our favorite place was not even on there. And then they were both like, for the better, you know?
The place has been around for 43 years.
Been through four generations of families.
Yeah.
It's great.
Puerto Alegre. Go there. It's
not going to win the James Beard Award, and thank God. You know?
And that was such a great line when Mac was like, yeah, all for the better. Because, you know, that's not the type of thing you want to happen.
No, to your favorite Mexican joint.
No. You think you could dig out a... is there an index? I doubt it.
No.
I doubt there's an index.
There is, so there's an epilogue.
About roast duck?
That'd be nice. And then... I mean, it seems to just be... It has a lot of color pictures, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, his wife's a photographer.
Oh, okay.
And she took all the photos.
So
it is a good couples book. I mean, at least it toes that tradition of couples writing.
But so he is walking from Paris to the Pyrenees, so he doesn't actually get into Spain. Like, his walk is just doing the French.
Yeah.
The French part. So let me look at this epilogue.
No, no, I want to see if there's any food.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, you have a little thing here.
What did I write? Did I say bullshit?
No, you just marked it. Oh, somebody says Nietzsche. There's a Nietzsche reference here. Okay, let's like cannons and lost. I mean, I don't. Okay, from farmyard to table.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, now we're getting closer to.
All right.
Talk to me about how the yolks of eggs are brighter when.
Well.
When ducks or chickens are.
Well, he's getting close. You were there when the calf was born? The woman's tone merged urgency, disbelief, and guilt. And the cream from the calf's mother? By now, she'd finished her portion of utterly unkosher, creamy veal and mushroom stew. She gulped. But the animals, they're like pets. They're so cute. Okay, also another thing to put on the... Making... Like, turning your fellow pilgrims into, like, buffoons. To make your reader sneer and say, oh, I great. Wouldn't be like that on
I
the road.
I would never be like that.
Oh, you'd veal all the time.
I would never be such an idiot. Ugh. All right, so this is great. He's...
Jolly and roistering until now, the table fell silent. Françoise was unflappable. That's what happens on farms, she said. You don't raise livestock for the fun of it. And then you have, of course, so this is also a national character. Like, ah, right. the
Françoise didn't
the
exist.
Rustic for, oh, French
yeah, farmer.
Farmer. She knows what's up. Jacques, her husband. Okay, Jacques and Françoise. Really? You expect me to believe that?
He literally did not leave his patio.
In Paris.
In Paris.
In the Marais. Jacques, her husband, a stocky, boisterous man well past 50, confirmed that everything on the table came from the farm. The orange-yellow, freshly churned butter, the goose pâté we'd had for starters, everything. Even the mushrooms came from the woods. Okay, we didn't make the wine, he laughed, pouring liberally from an old-fashioned demijohn and looking like a modern-day Bacchus. It comes from a friend's winery in Mercury. He makes it without sulfur, so it's practically organic. Drink to your heart's content. Our fellow diners took Jacques at his word. As the Mercury refilled the 10 wine glasses ranged around the big square table, I could see the moment of you killed the calf crisis passing. All 6 paying guests and 4 family members sighed simultaneously. Yes, the dream farm life had its unpalatable flip side, populated by slaughterhouses and butcher knives. But even the sensitive, inquisitive Belgian lady with qualms about veal and mother's milk allowed Françoise to serve her a second time. It was quite simply the most succulent homemade veal and mushroom stew that I or anyone else at the B&B had ever eaten. We took turns saying so. The goose pâté had been excellent, and it struck me as odd that no one wondered if Françoise had played Mother Goose before wringing the bird's neck. Patently, there was a hierarchy in our affections. As the conversation ranged wider, I felt a twitch of heartburn, wishing we wouldn't always be taken for ambassadors of our country's democratically elected administrations. All right, a little U.S. guilt there. Françoise's fresh goat cheese came to the rescue. It was tangy heaven on earth. The delicate apple tart, untainted by corn syrup and artificial anything, had a buttery shortbread crust as flaky as snow, the fruit filling still firm. I refused not to enjoy them. Okay, that's another one. American. So it's a specifically American self-hating, which I share, but not really. I don't hate myself. I hate America. but it's this self-hatred. That's like, we know how bad we are. That also romanticizes stupidly things like farm life. Because I remember very distinctly on this last Camino, it was early in the morning, and the unearthly wailing that we heard. And then we realized we were walking by a slaughterhouse. That's mm-hmm. farmland. That's not beautiful. It's not Françoise out there with her knife cradling the calf's head as she cuts it. Like, that's not how farming works anywhere in the world at this point.
Oh.
Ugh. Hate this guy.
So what'd you think of the tart description? Could we get that again?
Françoise's fresh goat cheese came to the rescue. It was tangy heaven on earth.
So
I want a little more shit talk there, because goat cheese tastes like
okay,
shit.
Okay,
it's delicious.
Okay. This is something I was about to mention. Fresh goat cheese is funky as hell.
And that's why we like it. It's not tangy.
Tangy.
Tangy, that's the stuff you get at the supermarket.
Tangy.
Like yogurt.
Yeah, I mean... The goat cheese I've had,
it doesn't have a tang.
Smells like
it has
a barnyard.
It's not tangy. It has a tang. It's like you know what is the word I'm thinking of? That's like a funk.
Yeah, no, I mean I'm thinking of the best goat cheese I've had, and it's often initially because you know you smell it before you eat it,
yeah,
and it's almost repellent.
Yeah, it smells like a goat barn. That was I remember very distinctly going in Amsterdam in the Amsterdam Sabas in the woods outside of the city. They have a goat farm.
And in fact, there's
hints of
it being sour.
And I walked in and I was like,
it
smells like goat cheese in here. And then I realized it smelled like goat shit.
Yeah, but it's hint, it's complexity that makes, I think, really nice food.
And it makes the back of your throat tickle.
Yes, and I think there's a hint of sourness. Mm-hmm. I think there's a hint of sweetness. And these things, you know, I don't know. It's difficult to write well for food, but
yeah.
I think the trick is use all your senses. What did it look like? Was it lumpy? Was it smooth? How was it served? What was the dish? What did it smell like? You know? What did it sound like when you cut it? Just use your senses.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, my impulse is to just go more Rabelaisian with it. Like, don't just tell me that you had tripe. Like, tell me that you had a plate piled high with tripe. Steaming coils of intestines were brought to you.
At the end of the day, what is this line Robert Anton Wilson has? He's talking about books, and he says, if a monkey looks in, a philosopher doesn't look out. And the idea is, if this is going to be an interesting story, you have to be interesting. Mm-hmm. If you're going to write, it can't be, you can't rely on the landscape to be interesting. You have to have a rich inner life. And it's that inner life that is then put on display in the book.
Yeah.
And so it's a delicate balance because you can't be totally internal, but that internal struggle, that internal process of interpreting the world has to be front and center.
Yeah.
And it's the tension between the internal world and the external world that gives drama its energy, its elan. And without that, you know, you end up with this person slacking off, you know.
I mean, and then the tart that you wanted to hear about is actually probably the worst line. The delicate apple tart, untainted by corn syrup and artificial anything.
Tainted?
Had a buttery shortbread crust as flaky as snow, the fruit filling still firm.
If I was his editor, I'd wring his neck.
I'd be like, as flaky as snow, what is this, grade school?
Wait, I don't understand that. As flaky...
Like snowflakes. Like a buttery, flaky crust.
Because if I was going to... let me rewrite this. Yeah. As flaky as eczema. As flaky as...
dried. As flaky as the blisters on my foot.
Yes, as flaky as extreme eczema. As flaky as dandruff.
My sunburn.
3-day dandruff in an old farmer's cap. You know what I'm saying? He's just trying... Yeah, I mean...
No, but it's the one that made me just die is untainted by corn syrup and artificial anything. Okay, we get it. Like, Monsanto exists... Yeah. And we've said it a million times, food tastes better in some places and not others. Like, fruit in the U.S. is, like, all factory farm.
It's fun to hate
on
things.
We get it.
It's fun to... I've made the determination that I hate this book.
But tell me what not... Don't just tell me it doesn't taste like artificial. Tell me what it does taste like, then.
Hot shot.
Challenge.
Hot shot.
Challenge.
So, Stella, it goes without saying that we're going to have to read this book.
Yeah.
At the same time. And
then he describes a breakfast. Ugh.
Okay, no.
No, it's not a description. It's Francoise Gourlier's breakfast, a fabulous feast of homemade jams, fresh baked brioche, and fresh cottage cheese was a long time ago.
So I love homemade cottage cheese because it doesn't taste like the thing you get at the grocery store.
Oh, no, yeah, it's just delicious.
So
fresh
if I was going to describe a meal I had on the road, I would describe, I don't know if you remember this, the day we passed that Neolithic site.
Oh, yeah.
And we went to that, you know, the guy had just opened
the flashing light that I didn't believe. There was a sign that said, abierto, abierto.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, there's no way that's abierto. Everything's been closed.
Yeah.
It's not abierto. It's a false flag. I didn't even go up the path.
Do you remember what we ate?
Yeah. We had the fresh squeezed orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
And a tortilla.
And then Ricky got just this bread with cheese on it. God, that was good. supermarket cheese.
I was so torta-centric on this last one. I wanted to have every tortilla. I wanted to have every tortilla that you could serve.
And that was a grocery store tortilla, too, but boy, was it good.
It was delicious. We're eating tortillas these days, I should say. Every morning we get up. They're called egg bites here in the United States.
And they don't have potato in them, but...
That's pretty damn close. We're getting there.
Yeah.
Which is...
I mean, the thing with the Spanish tortilla... I mean, there's the funny joke about, like, you know, goes to Spain, like, buys a paella pan and insists, like, it's pronounced paella.
Yeah.
You know.
España.
That part of the joke there, I think, which explaining a joke always makes it funnier, as we know, is that, like, it's just a basic food. And then you come back.
Paella?
Not, I mean, it's for parties and stuff, but it's, like, a normal thing that you would have at a party.
Yeah.
And tortilla is just like a normal breakfast food. But you come back from the Camino and you're like, I'm going to make you a Spanish tortilla.
Yeah.
And you like egg. Work all day on the potatoes and the egg when it was invented to use leftover potatoes.
Yeah.
And like too many eggs that you're, you know.
Yeah.
It's the locality of food. Becomes exotic, of course.
But dude, I love the idea that, you know, Spanish friends come to America, have my 7-layer nacho dip, and go back, and it's like, I have to make you the...
American... Seven-layer dip.
Siete-layer dip. And I'll tell you, it's...
I can't get good canned rice fried beans here. I have to make my own.
Yeah, exactly. No, that I did make a good 7-layer dip for 4th of July.
Yeah.
That's a meal in itself right there.
Oh, it was several meals.
Yeah.
Just lather that on something.
I remember you made me Frito pie once, which was really tasty.
Yeah. I don't really remember doing that, but I'm sure I did.
Okay, everybody. We're going to go to a track here. I'm feeling super nostalgic, so I'm playing the Dude Ranch album from Blink-182, which is just a great album. And so we're going to play a few tracks on that and then come back. And who knows?
Keep
maybe
hating on this book.
No, maybe we'll like the next pilgrimage book, but we'll see. This is Voyeur Blink-182.
The shades are going down. She was hanging googin' with the cougar. She was hanging out with Steve, and that was where she wanted to be. She was working at the place where they sell Vince Parmesan. Now she's gone. Now she's gone. Yeah, she's gone. He cried, he lost it all. He lost it all to Diana.
Diana,
part German, part Hispanic. Diana,
Diana,
Diana, where did you go? Oh, 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 oh.
Stella, do you want to come over here so you can read the lyrics to My Name is Jonas okay. by Weezer, which
we'll
I'm playing next?
Radio karaoke.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
Okay, we can share a mic as well. Wow. Dude, this song. Can you hear it? Oh, it's not playing over the monitors. Can you hear that? Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
What's happening, my man? We were just listening to Dude Ranch by Blink-182. That album is criminally underrated. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible.
It's an incredible album. In fact, I know who this caller is. This is my brother, my older brother calling from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. He and I saw Blink-182 tour the Enema of the State album in 2000. No, maybe 1998.
No, yeah, it was in the 90s, for sure.
Dude, do you remember that concert?
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, man. It was in the Fort Lauderdale Amphitheater.
That's right. It's the same place we saw like before WWF, there was like that word
ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling, yeah. And we saw. That's the
which
one
was
with
incredible.
They'd use like barbed wire instead of the ring ropes. They'd use and they like bashed each other into tables.
Yeah, it was incredible, incredible.
Well, Rob, you know, this is a show of pilgrimage and power spots. You just went to Vail. How was it? What sort of energies were you surfing through?
Well, Aspen and Vail. Mm-hmm. It's really great. I mean, I feel like everyone out there has figured out either I want to spend my life kind of like, you know, in the mountains doing mountain stuff, or I'm rich enough to just do this for 3 months out of the year when I want to.
So I've often thought of Aspen as a spiritual cousin to Miami, because both used to be pretty rockin' wild places that have attracted tourist after tourist after tourist after developer, developer, and developer. And now they're major destinations.
Yeah.
But did you still get a hint of the old weird Aspen? Is that still there? Or is it in Vail?
Well, Vail's really big. Vail's huge. Aspen's tiny. I mean, you can walk all of Aspen like fairly quickly.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. Is it in the mountains then, I assume?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aspen is very quaint, in my opinion. I think Aspen is, like just very, very quaint. You could do all of Aspen in like a morning if you wanted.
And you're talking.
We did have Aspen crud, which was pretty cool.
What's that?
So back in the day, during Prohibition, you know, obviously they couldn't drink, but the Hotel Jerome has like a great bar, and they found out that if you went inside that bar and you were like, "Hey, I want the Aspen crud," then they would give you like a milkshake with bourbon in it. But you had to ask for the Aspen crud, which is like kind of gross, you know. But.
And so, is that something that you sampled?
Yeah, we had it. It was gross. It's just, you know, I think, like, my wife and I were like, man, this just is not good, you know. This is like a perfect drink. Like, there's a reason this isn't a drink, you know. And then at Vail, we actually had gourmet hot chocolate, and it was spectacular.
Ah, like the Swiss.
Like it was like full bore, like homemade chocolate, and then they put like a little chocolate lattice on top of the cup, and then they like someone came out and poured hot chocolate over a homemade marshmallow.
So you know, we were just talking about the way food is described in travel novels. Chocolate encompasses a pretty broad spectrum of flavors. Yeah. How would you characterize, because there's some chocolate that is flavorless and it's, you know, it's extreme dark chocolate like cacao that is like bitter to the taste. And on the other end, there's like your milk chocolate. How do we dive into this giant glass of hot chocolate?
I mean, if I had to guess, I'd probably say it probably has to do with like a World War II situation where, you know, like probably a lot of people in Europe like hadn't had chocolate until like, you know, Hershey's showed up and, you know, like some GI gave it to him or whatever. But yeah, that's a really good question. I would probably venture a guess that it was probably early American chocolate was pretty bitter. And then, you know, Hershey's showed up and changed it. But then Europe was like, oh, we still have your bitter chocolate.
And we love it.
How did the hot chocolate taste, though? I mean, like, apparently this is a really ornate beverage. I mean, was it, you just mentioned the crud, not actually, I'm more interested in how things taste gross than how they taste delicious. It's the same principle, which is like, hey, look at this waterfall. Cool. You want to see a dead body? It's like, I'd much rather see something gross.
I think alcohol is, alcohol just doesn't go great with like iced, you know, beverages like, you know, a milkshake.
All right. So this
that was a discovery I made when I was a sophomore in high school, trying to find a way to drink alcohol and putting in a milkshake was not the answer.
It's got such a great name, you know, for like, it's like the perfect name for like a Prohibition era drink.
So this has me thinking of probably the worst thing I've ever drank. And I happen to have drank when I was with Rob in South Florida. And for me, you know, the earth has been colonized. Every inch is owned by some entity. So there's no more land to explore. The only frontier are defunct restaurant chains. You'll never get those flavors back. Mm-hmm. And perhaps Rob remembers the most disgusting drink maybe I've ever had. It was a place called Rockin' Robin. And it was down near Okeechobee Boulevard. And their
I loved Rockin' Robin, man. Great burgers.
Okay, their number one item was a special milkshake that was orange juice and milkshake.
Ugh.
Do you remember?
Yeah, it was like a fake orange Julius.
Dude, the milk was curdling. It was horrible. It was absolutely... Yeah. Do you remember... Can you recall the worst thing you've eaten recently?
The worst thing? The worst thing I've ever had. That's a really good question. What's the worst?
Or even like a recent bad thing.
Oh man, what a great question!
right, this is what I'm saying.
Bad. I mean, honestly, I thought that Aspen crud was just so poor. I mean, not only that, but it was also like $30.
Oh well, that'll make anything taste bad.
This is really putting up a pretty staunch fight for the worst item you could get.
Yeah, it was. I was really like, wow, man, what? And then you know, even the bartender was like, like you can tell. He's like, I got to get the blender out here, and I'm wearing cowboy regalia. You know what I mean? It's like, what? How? Why is this happening?
You know, I think that something America has really introduced to the culinary global scene is the it's an option. It's not an item. Hmm. It's an option.
Yeah.
And that's and all you can eat.
I'm begging you to not make me do.
That's the all you can eat. I think that, you know, like you show up to a place, it's like, all right, the Wild West is closed, but the gunfight is still an option.
All I can eat soup? Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. It was by far a hilarious situation. We'll put it that way.
Well, you know, I'm thinking now of all you can eat. Back in high school, that was a desirable quality. So it's like
such a boy high school thing to do.
This restaurant has all you can eat, and it so happened that a few restaurants, their only feature was all you can eat. Like, they wouldn't specialize in a cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
They would specialize in like 10 cuisines.
Yeah,
and was all you could eat. I can't remember the name of any of them, but man, they must have been getting grade E.
Yeah,
grade E food.
When I was in Texas, there was a famous Spanish restaurant, Tex-Mex restaurant called Joe T. Garcia's.
Mm-hmm. Joe T. Garcia's,
and they only served like one meal a night, one or two dishes a night, and it was like, take it or leave it. Like that was it. It was like okay, here's what we got tonight. We got like an enchilada dish and like a taco dish, and this is what it is. Like it was, like that's this is like what you're getting.
You know, actually, that seems trustworthy to me because at least they do it right.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah. Look. Joe T. Garcia's is famous. It's like a famous spot.
It's been around for a while. It's not like a new restaurant.
Oh no, it's been around for like 100 years.
Oh nice.
Yeah. And it's good. Joe T. Garcia's is. I mean, I think it's like an institution. Most people are pretty impressed with Joe T. Garcia's when they try it. They're like, oh wow. And the margaritas are like famous. They give you like pitchers of margaritas. But it's just like a little casita. It's like an old house, and it's pretty good.
All right, Stella. This has me thinking. Can you picture the Tex-Mex restaurant in your hometown? Like,
oh yeah. I've sung you the jingle before.
What is it?
It was called Mexico Restaurant. Mexico Restaurant, a fiesta for your mouth.
Is this the one? Taco, taco, taco.
No, that was a song we made up.
Oh, about
Celebración, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you know about Casa Bonita?
Oh, is that the one bought by Trey Parker
yes.
and Matt Stone?
Yes.
So St. Augustine, Florida, they bought a tradition.
No, it's in Denver.
Ah, okay. And so did you go? Did you have any?
No, but my wife, Leanna, has been wanting to go forever.
My wife.
And she scored a reservation, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. She didn't go, though?
No. We have to, like, make plans. It's like a future plan. It's crazy.
Oh, so something I've always enjoyed is in the film Delicious Man, Demolition Man. I'm already thinking about the restaurant. Rob, do you remember the only restaurant that exists in the future according to Demolition Man is this like really funny cyberpunk movie mm-hmm. with Wesley Snipes and Sylvester Stallone and Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
And it's like it's a really fun romp. I should recommend it to the Basement VHS boys. Anyways. There's this weird product placement. I think of it like it'll be in history books of like how to do product placement right. Because it doesn't feel in your face. It's like a funny detail that in the future they call it the chain wars. And it's all the food chains go to war and the only one that survives is Taco Bell.
I mean, makes sense.
Yeah.
They also have
They have Baja Blasts. That's a powerful weapon right there.
The Baja Blast is the name of their plasma rifle.
Exactly.
That's really what
they've been developing all these years.
They also have one of the most interesting enigmas introduced in modern cyberpunk cinema, which is you go to take a shit, and the only way that you can cleanse yourself is three seashells.
And they never explain it.
Yeah, so the guy goes in.
Oh, yeah, no, I've seen that scene where he's like, he's new or he's from the past.
Well, he's from they thaw him out.
Oh, it's an Austin Powers situation.
It's an Austin Powers spinoff universe, yeah. Though I have given a lot of thinking about how you would use three seashells.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me.
Oh, it makes no sense. I don't think it's supposed to make sense, though.
I think that's how they've They have
what if you use two together, like a little clamp, just to snip it off?
Figure it out yourself.
But why three?
Because then the other one's to scrape away the excess.
You know, that's a great question. If I had to really unpack it, I would say someone walked into someone's bathroom and they had three seashells on the top of the toilet and no toilet paper. And they came out and they said, how am I supposed to do that? And the filmmaker's like, you didn't use the three seashells.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Rob, I'm still curious. Can't summon up the worst thing you've had in a long time? Like a pot pie with a hair in it, a bag of popcorn with a toenail sticking out.
No. I think when you get older, you start doing like a really good job of just being like, I'm not eating somewhere I hate, you know, like that just ain't me. Like I'm not, you know, like I got it now. I can afford to not force myself into a dicey situation. That you know, just because like, oh, this place has great tilapia, you know, it's like, oh man, you know, that sounds awesome, yo. But I don't even like, you know, I don't even like tilapia.
Roach of the sea.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people, you know, they like to show off their spot, but you know, you get older and you get that ability to just be like, nah, fam. Like, nah, I don't need that.
I mean, you know, when I get in a car in a foreign city, I'm like, yo, take me to that Pizza Hut that has the red plastic cups and a smoking section.
Yeah, and I mean, that's incredible, right? Like, that's awesome. But there's just a lot of, you know, people love, they love, like, that weird authenticism that sometimes can get you in a lot of trouble, you know?
Oh, I'm thinking of the film Bridesmaids.
Yeah.
That authentic Brazilian steak.
Yep.
Yeah, you got to keep the authenticism to a minimum.
To a healthy minimum.
When you're in like India, it's like no.
I don't have the gut flora
for
this.
The opposite of authentic. I need synthetic.
I need white people food.
Yeah. Yeah. Please don't do that to me. I don't want to die here.
Though I did enjoy, you know, whenever I'm in South Florida, there is South Florida cuisine, which is not usually recognized in the New York Times. But you ever heard of a hush puppy?
I love a hush puppy.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, it's a little cornmeal.
Yeah, it's like
fritter.
Fried dough.
Yeah,
it's
conch fritter.
Well, that's a conch fritter. No, hush puppies don't always have conch in them.
Oh, I thought hush puppies were only conch.
No, usually they have like big
corn
kernels in them.
No, that's a conch fritter.
we're throwing around the term conch fritter like it's common knowledge what a conch fritter is.
Yeah,
it's not. I didn't know until I came
actually,
to Florida.
So. I think it's good, but hush puppies. They got that name from during slavery times, during the Underground Railroad. Slaves would throw the fried dough one way, and
to get the dogs
sneak
to,
away the other way, and they would use it to keep the dogs quiet. Yeah,
that was also a childhood shoe brand. That did like saddle shoes, like hush puppies, were like a saddle shoe you could get.
Listen, I did not intend on hearing such interesting history, but you know these terms we use seem so common. But I guess they all have a history; they all have an origin date. You know.
Yeah.
But what else is Florida cuisine? Because I'm thinking the conch fritter is it's like the Florida contribution to global
fried food.
No. You said every culture has its dumpling.
Oh yeah.
Conch fritter is Florida's dumpling.
Nice.
And there's a conch fritter sauce.
Oh.
That is like it's like a pink sauce.
Oh, it's not like a tartar sauce.
Rob would know more about this. Rob, what is a conch fritter sauce? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's usually like you know, like a Bahamian.
Yeah.
Like a Bahamian option.
What else is...
Key lime pie would be
Key lime pie
thing.
Is Key West. And just a lot of seafood, I would say. Yeah. Like a lot of dolphin.
Oh,
I mean, what's so Florida cuisine? Obviously, yeah, key lime pie is big. Florida lobster.
I didn't think about Florida lobster.
Yeah, Florida lobster.
They're smaller than Maine lobsters. That's right.
Gator.
That's right. Yeah.
Gator tail. Mm-hmm. So there's a place, believe it or not, by our old house called RJ Gators.
Why weren't you taking me there?
And we don't know what the RJ stands for. No one knows.
Ronald Julius.
Yeah, we just don't know.
And you could get gator tail there.
I like gator. I've had it before.
I'd say frog legs.
I love frog legs.
It's Floridians frog legs, and the French.
For sure.
I love frog legs. Yeah, it's Cajun.
Okay, so it's Catholic.
Yeah, it's like white French Catholics.
White French Catholics. Yeah. Which Florida was, let's not forget, founded by the Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And it is
Florida.
It's the land of flowers. It is the flower world. And I've always loved that idea that, like, what is Florida? Florida is floral. It's it's tropical. Mm-hmm. It's abundant. Mm-hmm. It's so much so that they found it sexually indiscriminate. That if you read some of these early accounts of Spanish colonists, they showed up and they said, like, all of these flowers are, like, sexually indiscreet. They would say, the women are becoming heated as a result of all of this flora.
I could see that. Yeah, that makes sense.
But, you know, I'm currently reading Game of Thrones, the book Song of Fire and Ice. And what really interests me is there's a scene where Robert Baratheon, the king, is killed on a boar hunt.
Yeah,
and,
classic.
Yeah.
Classic and, way for kings to get killed. And, regicide.
And I was thinking, oh my God, like, going back to our youth, Rob and I used to, I don't know if we wanted to, at least I'll speak from my own perspective, I feel like I was dragged to hunting camps because I think I was much more of a brooding, brooding child. But these hunting camps were serious, and what we would hunt is boar. That was the...
Wow.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yeah, wild boar are a problem pretty much everywhere. On the Camino, they're a problem. In Spain, in Japan, when we were on the Kumano Kodo, mm-hmm. they were a problem. Mm-hmm.
You have any recollection of those days?
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, boar hunting. I broke my nose boar hunting.
Oh, damn! Mm-hmm. The boar get you? Or?
It was terrible.
No, the boar did not get him.
Oh,
I don't think.
Did you punch him?
No,
Jojo. Did you punch your brother?
No,
no. Yeah, I broke it. A scope.
As far as I can tell, we were sharing a blind. We were sharing a boar stand, which is a little plank of wood that is affixed to a tree about 12 to 15 feet up.
Yep.
And you have to wait there. And they build these around what they call boar runs, which are trails that boars use to get around whatever scrub they're getting around. And so you'll see, because the dirt is all uplifted and it's a total mess, but it's like a mud pit. But, you know, if you're a tracker, that to you is a prime signal that this is like a highway for these wild pigs. And, of course, my dad in his, you know, inestimable intelligence says, oh, you two... You know, you're small. You know, you're 8 and he's 9. I don't know how old you were. What did you think? 10, maybe? 11?
Yeah, I was pretty tiny.
I mean, we didn't have driver's license, you know, like to give you some idea.
No, definitely not. No, definitely not.
And anyways, we were up there for 3 or 4 hours, and it's, you know, this is before social media. So today, both of us would be on TikTok, sharing memes, making big jokes. It'd be a great laugh. We'd have a lot of fun. We'd probably vape.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got to be honest. I think it would be, like, much more fun to hunt these days.
By virtue of how much fun you could do social media stuff.
Yeah. There was a lot of just, like, waiting.
Yeah. So anyways, this boar swings around the run. And my brother shoulders this .30-06, you know, which is a large hunting rifle. It's .306, mm-hmm. and that's the size of the caliber of the round.
Yeah.
So it's the size, right? Isn't that the
Yep.
Which is like a long, you know, hunting piece of ammunition. Anyways, because there's two boys, you know, probably wearing camouflage pajamas. And like unlaced boots, you know, he couldn't fit it properly on his shoulder. And so what you want is that what you want is the rifle to really be flush against the meat of your shoulder. So when the recoil hits, it won't snap back. You know, you won't lose. Like, you know, there are some videos online of people shooting rifles with the butt of their gun too far up, and the gun like flies out of their hands backwards. Anyways, we were sharing this.
Yeah, that was accurate, actually.
We were sharing this blind, and my brother pulled the trigger, and the butt of the gun was too high up because, you know, no doubt I was breathing down his neck, you know, and came back.
Oh, no.
And it was the scope of the rifle that actually hit him in the...
Ow, wow.
But I think you killed the boar, incidentally. So.
Yeah, but it broke my nose, and... And then I got called, like, Scope Nose for a while.
Sounds like a Charles Dickens character.
Scope Nose.
Yeah, Scope Nose, which is terrible.
Though I do remember one thing that's very clear to me is at these hunting camps, the smell of cleaning a boar. So they would string them up by their legs upside down.
Yeah, let it bleed out. Yeah.
Yes. And so the blood would then drip out into a bucket, and the dogs would be like all in this bucket, and the flies would be everywhere. And you would take this big, what they call a hunting knife, and just go from stem to sternum. Yeah, you go, rooter do the tooter, the tooter do the rooter.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And they would skin it. And so you'd have this sort of meat skeleton. And then they would open up the chest and start scooping out
organs
and bile.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You didn't want to nick the gallbladder.
No.
Gallbladder?
Yeah, you can't nick gallbladder. Yeah, because bile will go everywhere.
So all I remember is the smell of it being like something I feel like I could get used to.
Yeah.
But I wasn't at
You would never be like, yum, yum.
To tell you the truth, I was much more interested in the Playboys that they had strewn around the cabin. And I was like,
what? To sop up the blood?
They put it in their boots. They had holes in their boots and they put it in centerfolds.
Yeah, it was a wild time. That's for sure. That is for sure.
Yeah, hunting as a gentleman's sport.
Yeah, that was a wild, wild, wild situation for sure.
Well, Rob, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Listen, if that most disgusting meal you've had in recent memory comes to you, please let us know.
The most disgusting meal I've ever had.
Not like, ever,
give me
but
like,
in
give me like 5 seconds.
In recent memory, you thought you got something and you went, no.
I mean, I can tell you the time that probably one of the few times in my life that I'm like, I can't eat this, which was this particular French sausage called andouillette. And I thought it was like andouille sausage, which is like a spice sausage that they have in Louisiana. And andouillette, the et suggested it was just a small version of it. So I was expecting like little like breakfast links of spiced sausage. But it's actually a sausage casing, but inside is just pig intestines. So you cut it and it just goes and they serve it with this like grainy mustard. And even though I doused it in mustard, I couldn't. I got through like 2 bites of it and I was like, I cannot eat anymore.
Listen, let me tell you, this is something major. Stella, I've seen you eat a hockey puck size raw beef
tartare with a patty. Raw egg on it. Yeah.
With a raw egg on top.
Love it.
I've seen you scarf it, not a little. It was ground beef hockey puck.
Yeah.
I've seen you scarf it and then scoop up like the last little bite of raw beef patty.
Delicious.
No more raw egg. And I thought, well, there's that.
There. So, yeah. So this I don't recommend.
For me, I remember I was eating at what was my favorite restaurant in the entire universe, which is Kanka, which is a Japanese restaurant in the East Village. And I remember they served tripe.
Yeah.
And it had, it smelled like offal. It smelled like intestine.
Yeah.
I can only eat one or two.
And it's a good restaurant, but it's certainly not high end. So no. I think they gave that tripe like a one wash.
Yeah.
And you should wash tripe at least 3 times because it's got literal poo poo in it.
Yeah, that's
so it had a flavor of
do
the
you
anus.
Remove the poop from your shrimp?
Yeah.
Does everybody?
No, I mean it's fine if you eat shrimp poop.
Okay.
But no. It's
I had my first shrimp in 10 years last night.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
Oh, how was it?
Delicious. I'm gonna have and I didn't have any reaction, no, so I think didn't. I'm gonna have a shrimp meal tonight.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Rob, nice. What do you think? You got the gross one? You got the yucko?
I mean I had like a blood sausage once in Ireland at this like dog shit golf course. And oh my god! And it was like bleeding on the plate, and it tasted like blood. And I was like, "Oh boy!"
And so, did it come in a bun?
No, it was just gross.
Yeah, that's the there's some foods that just are not good to your palate. But the added factor is when you go to a place and you're like, "This place is not hygienic. No matter what they serve me here, I know it's gonna go badly."
Yeah. Yeah, and I think sometimes in those European spots, like, you get, it gets a little dicey. Especially European golf courses, because they don't, it's just not the same, level of, like, if it's not good, they're like, yeah, too bad.
Yeah, you're stuck, you're here on the golf course, what do you want?
Yeah.
All right, Rob, lots of love. Thanks for calling in, man. We'll catch up later.
Yeah, great talking with you.
Yeah.
Bye.
All right, bye. So I have to say, always a pleasure to have a fellow traveler on the air with us. It's a true joy. But, Sally, if you remember, we are in the middle of singing.
My name is Jonas.
My name is Jonas. Okay, so I'm going to put this, I'm going to put it on, and we can sing in the studio.
Woo!
And we hope you enjoy, everybody. This is My Name is Jonas by Weezer. I mean, come on, this is the Blue Album. What could you not like? We're now... Yeah, Stella? We're now going to... We're just saying there's two tiers of Weezer song. The first tier... It's Buddy Holly, it's Sweater Song, it's Hash Pipe.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Hash
There's a second tier that is all the good songs. My name is Jonas, The World Has Turned.
El Scorcho, my favorite.
El Scorcho. Undone is really good, too.
Oh, that is a good one.
The whole Blue Album.
Yeah.
The whole Blue Album.
Well, that was the one I think that I became aware of them, really.
I think, see, that's an album that you have to listen to.
Yeah.
It's mandatory. All right. I think I might indulge.
Yes, do it.
And sing this. I remember when I was in Japan, there was a lot of Weezer.
Weezer core?
Weezer music.
I mean, that Rivers Cuomo was the outfit that launched the thousand hipsters. The dark
Still
glasses.
Left me
the, like,
here.
Sweaters. And khakis.
Before you appeared.
And bad attitude.
In your place, an empty space. Turned and left me here
just where I was before you appear, and in your dreams an empty space has filled the void.
Listeners, you might not know this, but Stella claimed to know every word to El Scorcho.
I do.
And you are all very fortunate.